Hello, and welcome to the Regrettable Century. I'm Chris.
I'm Kevin.
I'm Jason.
And I'm Jenny.
And today, we are talking about anxiety, late capitalism, and how everything is boring. Okay, so we, in typical Regrettable Century fashion, cobbled together a list of readings from all the corners of the internet and focused around Mark Fisher's writings about anxiety in late neoliberal capitalism. And we found this article called We Are All Very Anxious, and it's posted by the Institute for Precarious Consciousness, which, as far as we can tell, is only exists to have posted this one article.
Yeah.
And it went up all over, like, far left, you know, the far left blog world. So, you know, it went up on Libcom and several other sites, not the least of which being a personal favorite of mine, which is CrimeThink, you know.
Yeah, this whole episode is already canceled.
Yeah, like, I read this article and I thought it was mostly pretty good, and then I saw that it was on CrimeThink and it was just like, oh man, this article sucks.
Well, it seems to originate with a kind of diffuse, multifaceted kind of like communist of the small c organization in the United Kingdom called Plan C, and I don't know anything about either of these groups. And you know, they're kind of, you know, they say like there are a lot of Plan Bs, you know, for capitalism, but they all don't work, and it's like social democracy, Keynesianism, Stalinism, whatever. So maybe a Plan C, so that's kind of clever or whatever. I don't know anything about them, so if they're terrible, you can try to at me, but I don't use Twitter, so you can't.
Instead, just go fuck yourself.
It's off to a good start.
No, but anyway, so this article, it's pretty good, and it gives us a decent framework to structure the podcast around. So we're just going to go ahead and start with that, and we're going to talk about Jody Dean's communicative capitalism and what Mark Fisher has to say about anxiety. Okay, so the Institute for Precarious Consciousness has 6 theses on anxiety and why it is effectively preventing militancy, and one possible strategy for overcoming it, which I think we all found to be way less useful than the 6 theses. But anyway, here we go. Each phase of capitalism has its own dominant reactive effect. And when we break this down, it seems very simple, and it makes me wonder why I never thought of it. And that is the modern era, which up until the post-war settlement, the dominant effect was misery. And what goaded militants into action was the motivation to combat and ameliorate as much misery as they possibly could. So, you know, in the 19th century, the dominant narrative was that capitalism leads to enrichment. And the way that this thesis works is that every single affect has a public secret. And that public secret is that capitalism also leads to immiseration of the working class while also leading to enrichment. So yes, we all acknowledge that capitalism in the 19th century led to immense enrichment, but at the same time, it brutalized and immiserated the working class.
Wait, can we
worldwide?
Can we talk about what a public secret is? That seems important.
Yeah. And what I mean by public secret is that everyone openly talks about how capitalism is good because it enriches, and sort of acknowledges that immiseration exists, but doesn't talk about it. Like, everyone knows that it exists, but they don't talk about it. And that's what the public secret is. And each one of these theses has its own public secret.
Right. So, like, according to these theses, the public secret in the early phases of capitalism was immiseration. And everybody knew it, and everybody was aware of, like, you know, children being worked to death in factories, and, you know, boom bust cycles throwing, you know, huge numbers of people out on the streets, and everybody kind of knows it. And it's
unsafe working conditions, rampant pollution, the squalor of like living in the industrial city and the slums. That's all there. Everyone knows about it, and the only people doing anything to combat it would be the militants. And the way that they organized to combat it was through labor unions, mutual aid societies, co-ops.
Political parties.
Political parties, yeah. Political parties were a big one. Like, the mass socialist parties came into existence as a reaction to the immiseration of the working class in the late 19th century. According to this thesis, when misery stopped working as a control strategy, capitalism switched to boredom.
Wait, which is to say that as trade unions became, like, effective in negotiating the rate of exploitation by winning contracts and winning labor laws, and political parties representing the working class
gain power in, you know, Western Europe,
right? Or at least
like
influence,
yeah.
But certainly, yeah, power in some cases, right? We're talking about like the traditional forms of organized labor at the shop floor and at the ballot box, like effectively mitigating, when they're powerful, the worst excesses of immiseration. That's
right.
Is that an accurate reading? Like, that's what it means.
Yeah, definitely. This says that when misery stopped working as a control strategy, capitalism switched to boredom. So in the mid-20th century, the dominant narrative was that the standard of living had given everyone access to healthcare, consumer goods, education, and, you know, everyone had a car, everyone owned a home. This is that's the dominant narrative. Of course, it's not true for everyone, and especially not for people of color. And the open secret is the affect, according to this terminology, was that everyone was bored. Like, we all know the trope of the bored housewife in the 1950s, and the idea of just of Fordism, factory production, being mind-numbing and boring. And even though everyone's got safer jobs, stable lives, and relative comfort, everyone is bored to tears. And that boredom is, according to this, you know, article, part of what it's used to dampen militancy.
Well, right. And I think it's trying to engage in a sort of a dialectic, right? It's trying to recognize that this is a point of contention within society. It's a point of, like, this is the sort of the dominant fault line around which the thesis and antithesis emerge in the class struggle. It says that, you know, the early appearance of capitalism, it was immiseration was the dominant thing experienced, but also the dominant point against which the population was organizing to resist capitalism. In the next period, it was boredom that was the dominant negative experience, but also the dominant point of resistance that that appeared in where resistance appeared. It was, you know, the beatniks. It was the later the hippies. It was the this resistance against the stultification of suburban middle class life that was afforded by Fordist capitalism that was the answer to the period of immiseration before it, right?
Right.
I think, being very generous to the authors of this, I want to go out on a limb and assume that the argument is that where the working class had been able to develop effective strategies for fighting the immiseration of capitalism, that flowing from that set of circumstances, the next another terrain in the struggle against class society kind of revealed itself, which is the struggle against the alienation, right? So that, like,
right,
it's not to say that the world over everybody had a good union job but they were bored. But rather, where you had a good contract, you know, and jobs security and, you know, the assembly line dominated your life, but you had a week vacation or whatever, that the mind-numbing, sort of stultifying, alienating, boring lives that sort of bureaucratically ordered society produces just necessitated another element of struggle. Because I think it would be foolish and I think it would just be foolish. It would be wrong to look at like the 1960s in, you know, Japan, Mexico City, Paris, the United States, whatever, and be like, oh yeah, that's basically the same as Mozambique, Vietnam, South Africa. But I don't think that I don't get the sense that that's what this sort of piece is arguing.
No, in fact, the last paragraph of this section says, of course, not all workers under Fordism actually had stable jobs or security, but this was the core model of work around which the larger system was arranged.
Okay, word, yeah. I'd forgotten about that part.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, even if the piece didn't state that, you know, I think if a piece is worth engaging with, it's worth engaging with charitably. And that means reading it in the most favorable light, in the most generous sort of favorable light that you can possibly read it in.
Are you new to the internet?
I've been accused of that many, many times.
Okay, so basically this section concludes by saying that job security for life, welfare, and, you know, the sort of compromise between trade unions and bosses that allowed for stability and abundance produced boredom. And contemporary resistance is born from the 1960s wave in response to the dominant affect of boredom. And if each stage of the dominant system has a dominant affect, then each stage of resistance needs strategies to defeat or dissolve the affect. So that of the 1960s and 70s were primarily organized around fighting boredom. And that is the pretty much the left that we are familiar with now was born then. So most of the tactics of that era were sort of like geared towards combating the idea that you had to consume and die, right? They call it the work, consume, die cycle. The situationist pioneered tactics directed against boredom, saying, we do not want a world in which the guarantee that we will not die of starvation is bought by accepting the risk of dying from boredom. The entire hippie movement, the tune in, turn off, drop out of society, you know, back to the land movement, then the punk movement, all comes out of this idea that boredom needs to be combated by altering your lifestyle and consumption.
Well, and it's also the case that like the wave of distinctly kind of, well, let's say like second wave feminism is very much bound up in this as well, right? Like the movement to get, you know, on the shop floor around like women in the workplace it's not divorced from this, but it's sort of like, it's a precursor, right? Whereas the movements against oppression, against women's oppression in this era look more like earning respect for women as women rather than women as workers, which is not necessarily to say that one is better than the other, but it's the next sort of element of the next element of women's liberation is women in society more generally. Is that, again, a charitable reading?
Yeah. This says that in the feminist movement, the housewife malaise that I mentioned earlier was theorized as a systematic part of Fordist capitalism in the 1960s. And then later, further dissatisfactions were revealed through consciousness raising.
Yeah, this is the origin of like politics around oppression. It's the wages for housework argument. I feel like boredom is probably the wrong... Boredom is a good word, right? To describe this sort of general malaise of like stable life in under capitalism, but I feel like they're trying to they're using the word to encapsulate more things than most people think of when they think of boredom.
They're using it to encapsulate alienation.
Yeah,
like the alienation of that. I mean, Marx is writing about worker alienation in regard to the first set of conditions that this article talks about, but then other thinkers have gone on to elaborate on alienation in much, much greater detail. But this is alienation. That's what they're talking about when they say boredom. They're talking about just being completely dissociated from what it is that makes you human, but still having stability. And smarter people than I have theorized that that is pretty much the the start and end point of all of the modern ills that plague society.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Is there anything about this section that anybody like fundamentally disagrees with or finds like useless or, I don't know, limited in some way?
I think it's hyper-focused on the first world, which limits its usefulness, but I don't think that that is necessarily wrong-headed because it's trying to speak to anti-capitalist resistance, to the nature of anti-capitalist resistance in the first world. So, I don't know. I don't object to that. But it is a limitation of it.
I kind of object to the idea that the way that it sets it up is when capitalism switched from its opening stages of accumulation to Fordism, they decided to come up with the idea of boredom to keep people down, you know? And I just think that they frame it wrong.
Sure. Well, I also think like the type of boredom and alienation is a product of, it's not something that was like conjured up by the ruling class, you know? And I don't know. I think like a good faith reading of this, though, like it may seem implied, would say like, I think they just described it as accurately as they could in the number of characters they used or words or whatever. I do think that like, and this might be like way far off base because of my particular like place and experience and the things that come to mind when I think about like the way like alienation and work in like the home, you know, so like talking about housewives, is that like the level of boredom they describe, which is like obviously not true. I mean, I guess it is true for like women in the workplace. The shit's boring and sucks oftentimes. But one of the things that comes to mind is like there's just the necessity to not be able to even just do like whatever boring housewife or mom things they think they're describing is like the rise of multi-level marketing and the focus on like getting housewives to participate in that sort of labor, which is like ultimately overwhelmingly alienating because you don't have a workplace, you don't really have coworkers other than people you're trying to like get to work underneath you selling your like Mary Kay or now essential oils or weird shakes or whatever the fuck else you're selling, right? Man, I had a point with this multi-level marketing rant and I lost it.
Maybe you can pick up the thread in the next section because...
Yeah. Well, I think that it gets to the part of what you're saying, Jenny, gets to the question that I think Chris raised, which was assigning, you know, whether we assign a sort of intentionality to a social structure such as capitalism or not. It's easy to sort of slide between, you know, functional aspects of a social structure and the social structure having having that as an intentional output. But I think it's, one can read even the least well-phrased text that explicitly puts a sort of conscious intentionality behind things like that. You know, you can read it a bit more generously and say pretty much the exact same thing and just understand it as viewing a progression of here is an unintentional consequence of a previous action or a previous sort of course of events that happened. Here's an unintentional consequence. And then there is no incentive or there is no internal logic in the social structures that exist that address this unintentional consequence. And so it becomes a dominant feature because it is a consequence of the prior course of events, and there's nothing inherent in the social structures that exist that has any reason or cause to address it. So if we that's a lot less like poetic, you know, and a whole lot more words. So, I don't know. I think it's fair to sort of allow a certain poetry that assigns a sort of conscious intentionality to capitalism, while reserving a bit more of a sort of staid, you know, scientific analysis of how social structures actually work, you know?
Yeah, I've found that, like, some of the most bad faith critiques of, like, the critique of capitalism generally, or even, like, left-wing takes on the writings of, like, Debord and Sanguinetti and the Situationists, like, referring to the spectacle as it desires this and it seeks that or whatever. And it's kind of the way that we all talk about, like, well, you know, capitalism wants this to happen to you, or capitalism wants you to do that. It's like, we don't literally mean that there's, like, a board of directors for capitalism and they, like, voted, oh, this is... We're switching to the boredom affect. I think, yeah, like...
Initiate boredom sequence C.
And I think the reason why maybe that's like a... We even feel like we have to make a disclaimer about that now is because in the absence of, like, widespread left-wing, like, sort of diffusion of left-wing ideas through society, that people are really used to the talking about politics in terms of, like, the president wants this, or else in terms of, like... conspiracy theories where, like, that cabal or that, you know, whatever, the deep state or the Illuminati or whatever, like, people are used to thinking about power in terms of, like, very specific, deliberate, intentional plans of action by, like, people with their hands on the history machine, you know?
Sure.
And I guess in a way I'm just agreeing with what everybody else has said already. So never mind.
Thesis 3. Capitalism has largely absorbed the struggle against boredom.
I feel like that is fucking spot on. I don't know. Like,
well, I mean, I would say, like, wholly absorbed the struggle against boredom.
Yeah, no, not like partially. This section, whenever I got to this section, it's sort of like, I don't know, a lot of times whenever you study philosophy, especially the history of philosophy, there's a lot of this sort of here, swallow this giant pill. But once you swallow this pill, this whole system just makes so much sense. If you can get past this sort of, like, these series of assumptions that we're making at the outset. I felt like that a lot with this, which it was sort of like, here, just buy this sort of, like, framework that we're setting up. Then whenever it got to this, the third thesis, I was just like, God damn, that is fucking spot on.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, like,
I just want to note that the third thesis hasn't really been established yet.
Sorry.
We're just like, no. So, we should probably...
All right. Okay. Let's hear the whole of it, yeah.
There has been a partial recuperation of the struggle against boredom. Capitalism pursued the exodus into spaces beyond work, creating a social factory, a field in which the whole society is organized like a workplace. Precarity is used to force people back to work within an expanding field of labor, now including the whole of the social factory. So, you know, it mentions that companies have adopted flattened management models that incite employees to not only manage, but invest their souls in their work. Consumer society provides a wider range of niche products, and constant distraction, which is not determined by mass tests to the same degree as before, and new products like video games and social media that involve heightened levels of active individual involvement and desocialized stimulation. So it has created essentially, like, the gig economy, social media, open workplaces, a work environment where everyone is a bunch of friends and your boss is just another friend, you know, or a right. family.
Teamwork.
You know, yeah, we're all a team. We're all, yeah, a team. What is it that they always say at, it's like, we're associates, not yeah. workers. And all of our customers are guests, you know? So it's basically taken all of the things that people didn't like about capitalism in the Fordist era and basically put a veneer on him that makes him seem more palatable. Like, everyone thinks that whenever I tell people I work from home, they're like, oh, that's so cool that you get to work from home. And I'm like, no, it fucking sucks to work from home.
Yeah, man, this work invaded my home and completely took it over. There's no safe sanctuary from work because it follows you everywhere.
It's essentially like, you know, I get off the assembly line and then I crawl underneath it and go to sleep, you know?
Well, have you ever seen this meme? That's like it's a guy, the first panel is a guy at his desk at work looking at his computer screen and he's got this like sullen face. And the next panel is he's like in bed with a big smile on his face. Like clearly he's like watching like Netflix on his laptop. And it says, "So tired of looking at bad screen. Can't wait to go home and look at good screen."
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Best podcasting is when you describe memes.
Well, this is the podcast for you then, because we describe a meme or a tweet in every episode. The idea of rebelling that came about in the 1960s and 70s has now been successfully commodified and sold back to us.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's by our own generation and the generation that's slightly older than us, because they have internalized the lessons of the hippies in the 1960s without any of its revolutionary content, because capitalism is excellent at recuperating and using social movements to sell products.
Well, it's similar to the argument about left liberal, you know, capitalism with a human face in the period when the, you know, that they're defining as was when the struggle against boredom kind of began, right? It's that like having a union was something people had to fight and die for, and then capital figured out a way to absorb and, you know, and to negotiate with the existence of self-organization so that you could have trade union bureaucrats who are in the same country clubs as the bosses, and you've got a contract now, but your union's no longer threatening the social order, right? Like the capitalists aren't like running in fear because the workers have unions. Not that they like unions, but they had figured out how to, at least, you know, in the advanced industrial economies with a degree of social, they managed to achieve some social stability as a result of the kind of Herculean struggles of the working class in, you know, the 1910s, 20s, 30s, 40s. So by the 50s and 60s, they're like, yeah, fine. Yeah, you can have a union. And that meant that they were able to sort of work it into their plans. And unions become managers of labor, right? So that's like also part of this generation of radicals' criticism of the role of unions in Western Europe and in Eastern Europe, that it's basically the same thing, that the labor management partnership is to the benefit of management and not to the benefit of labor. So similarly, you fast forward another generation and they've figured out like, oh yeah, you feel alienated and bored and like you're living a meaningless, lifeless, soulless existence. Well, rather than, you know, having revolution be like a joyous occasion where you like revolt against all of the constraints of society, all the limitations about, you know, your long hair or like men and women in the same dorms or even like, you know, the questions of deviant lifestyles, which we now, you know, we have pride parades and whatever. It's like they've figured out like, okay, these are things we have to sort of tolerate and accept and incorporate into the functions of the system. So like on the face of it, this doesn't seem to me to be like incredibly controversial. But if you actually talk about it in these terms, I think there's a lot of room for debate on the left about all of this.
Right. And you can see this rebellion being actively recuperated throughout the 1960s and 70s and into the 80s with, you know, the fact that the CIA funded the avant-garde art and music scene in, you know, in the late 60s and early 70s, so that they could, the points of capitalism say, look at what capitalism comes up with. Like, you know, look what the Soviet Union comes up with. They're drab square buildings and ill-fitting clothing and stuff like that. They could always point to, you know, the fact that capitalism isn't boring the way socialism is. And so you actively see the affect switching, you know, to use the terminology of the writers of this article, then. And the same thing happens with punk, you know?
Right. Like, you had a situation at one point where MI5 was tailing and, you know, eavesdropping on the Sex Pistols and going through their garbage and treating them like, you know, the same way that the FBI treated members of the Communist Party in the 1950s. And then within 3 years, you got Warner Brothers advertising new bands that they signed to their label, and with like Bugs Bunny with like a purple hair and a leather jacket. And it's really funny because it's taken us even to the present day that people still think being creative is somehow like inherently threatening to the man.
Yeah.
And it has long since ceased to be threatening. But also that maybe even has long since ceased to be possible to be like really, really creative in a way that is like challenging. Like, how do you challenge a status quo which desires your every single thought to be put out into the world so that it can respond to it? You know, it used to be that like, these are the rules, this is the desired outcome of your interaction with the marketplace, with your boss, with your neighbor, and whatever. And so, you know, rebellion looked, and maybe it was a little bit more obvious what rebellion was or could be, you know.
And right, like with the Jody Dean article that we read about communicative capitalism, one of the things that she says is that content being created constantly is what is desired, regardless of what it is.
Right.
And Mark Fisher also talks about, he expounds on what Jody Dean is saying. They are talking about, I guess these were written, it had to have been written, of course, before Mark Fisher died, obviously.
Yeah, I would guess. Yeah.
He talks a lot about blogging and comments on blogs and messaging. He's not even talking about like Twitter and Instagram and stuff like that. But
he's talking about a long lost age of discourse,
right?
Compared to the like and retweet.
The same thing applies, though. So it's like content being created. You could think of it as revolutionary content. So I'm posting revolutionary memes and my comrades are liking and saying things like, yeah, we'll get them, guillotines and stuff like that. And that doesn't mean anything to anybody. And it's all just being fed into this machine that creates more content and tailors algorithms that direct ads at you. So, you know, I get ads directed at me for Joseph Tito t-shirts.
Wait, really?
Dude, I'll never forget the Marx Revolution ringtones ad.
Oh yeah,
which was like it was just an ad for like, hey, come to this app to download ringtones. But it knew that the words that it needed to pitch at me in order to get my attention at the time, this is like 2009 or 10 or whatever, was Marx and revolution, because I guess those were words I had flung out into the internet a bunch of times.
Yeah, so it wants us to put anything into the machine and out into cyberspace, to use a incredibly dated term that Mark Fisher uses a lot. He says that we are not getting online, we are carrying a parasite with us that sucks our attention and sucks content out of us. You know, he's talking about using our phones. It constantly distracts us and sucks content out of us that's fed into this machine of communicative capitalism.
Right. Actually, in Fisher's kind of commentary on this, what are we calling this? The theses? In Fisher's commentary on these theses, one of the things that he said that I really, really found provocative was that the vacancy of boredom was once a challenge to produce something to fill the space, to live in sort of defiance of empty time, you know. And he talked a little bit about, like, with examples, like, used to be you'd stand at the bus stop and you just have to wait for the bus, so maybe you'd be daydreaming or whatever. And now what do you do immediately when you have a free moment? Is you grab your phone and just mindlessly scroll.
And I guess that's why I would kind of push back against using the words boredom and alienation interchangeably, or one of the reasons, at least, because, like, whereas now, I mean, like Fisher said, you know, we're never bored. Even if we are, we're always occupied. We're overstimulated. If I'm home, I'm cleaning, there's music on, or there's a podcast playing or Hulu's on, if I'm at work doing some like tedious labor, something's happening, if I'm on the elevator, I'm making sure my headphones are visible so no one's talking to me. If I'm, you know, waiting for a train or at the airport, I am constantly making sure I don't have to interact with other people, which is further alienating me from people, like when I'm doing this at my workplace or in my community, in the elevator, in the apartment that I live in, you know, where I'm further. So even though I'm not bored, because I'm watching like a cute dog or whatever, I am further alienating myself in the process of doing that, you know?
I was going to say, that's the thing is that you are bored, because you would never like stop what you're doing and go, I need to go look up a video of a cute dog. Or maybe you would, I don't know, but like most people would.
Jenny wouldn't might.
Go, oh, I need to stop what I'm doing and go look up a video of a cute dog. But you will if it's just in your pocket and you just are compelled to scroll
through
your feed.
That's why I liked Fisher's commentary on this. His title is, no one is bored, everything is boring.
Sure, yeah.
Because, you know, maybe you don't feel the exact same sensation you might have as a teenager when you could only get online whenever nobody was using the phone. And so you didn't think of it as a thing. It was more of like an activity, the way that listening to a record was once an activity before you could just stream music and you know, and so on. But it's still everything is still fucking boring. Like everything is stupid and lame. It really is.
True. It's true.
But you know, but we are still stimulated. You know, like we live in an age of multiple stimulations.
Hyperstimulation.
Even if we're being hyperstimulated by things that are terribly boring.
So yesterday I was listening to a podcast in one ear, and then I had my my headphones on, my over-ear headphones on, and I was playing a video game. So I was listening to the music from the video game and a podcast at the same time. And then on loading screens, I was like, you know, I would open up my phone and, you know, scroll through Instagram or whatever else. And I was just like, having just read this article, I was just like, fuck. Like,
yeah, that's a bit much, man.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what I do all the time, too. And it's Mark Fisher talks about reading a book and stopping reading a book because you got a notification on your phone. And you know it's just going to be like an app telling you like something that you would possibly shop for is having a sale. And you know that's what it's going to be, but you have to check just in case. And it's something mundane and stupid. And then having opened up your phone, you get sucked in. And you stop reading the very interesting book that you're reading that you're totally absorbed in. It's like a parasite that takes away your time, keeps you from doing things that you like so that you could do something that you don't like or don't care about. Even if you do like it a little bit, you don't like it more than the thing you were doing previously.
It's a compulsion.
It is. It's a compulsion. And, you know, I know we kind of sound like, you know, old guys complaining about like, back before people had phones, everything was better.
Yeah, this is the good conservative impulse that we talked about before.
Well, yeah. So, right, I was going to say this. It reminds me of what I found so compelling in the Spengler quotation in Dialectic of Defeat, where the sort of the characterization of this is like early mass media period, where it's like radio and, you know, airplanes and just all of the features of like progressive technologically advanced forward looking society. And that kind of drumbeat of progress that is celebrated by both capitalists and socialists alike. And then Spengler finding it to be cacophonous and overwhelming. And, you know, and it's this kind of, it's the romanticism for, you know, what Wordsworth would have called man in his natural state, or, you know, human beings detached from all of the Yeah, of all of the cacophony and overstimulation. But for Spengler, it's just talking about like what it seems just so quaint compared to the not just the perpetual advertisement and perpetual engagement with, you know, like what Jody Dean's talking about with, you know, just the fact that you're engaged in doing anything allows for the constant flow of information, which is a critical part of the way the economy functions today. But also, you know, the way that work has infiltrated every element of our lives, the way that every single interaction and everything we do is, if it itself isn't commodified, then it's like a part of commodification of something else. Like
right.
Spengler's overstimulating times, they're almost, yeah, they're quaint compared to what we're dealing with now.
Yeah, there's no wonder we're all just walking sacks of anxiety.
Yeah.
Just constantly. And I mean, I guess that kind of goes back to like how much of what capitalism produces is deliberate and how much of it is just a product for the drive for profit. You know, like, do we think that misery was a deliberate product of capitalism or just the natural consequence of like accumulating wealth, right? Do we think that boredom, you know, do we think that that's the same for boredom? And then do we think that that is the same for anxiety? You know, which is not to say that I don't think there's like a, you know, some like evil rich people just like tapping their fingers, thinking of ways to make us more fucking anxious or bored or miserable or whatever. But you know,
well, shit, some of them are.
Well, that's right? What I'm yeah. like that, well, that's that what I'm whole... saying. Like, I would never discount that. But I think there's a conversation to be had about how much of it is just the natural outcome of this drive for profit, and how much of it is like the people we picture when we picture like plotting capitalists trying to control our lives and make them more miserable, boring, and anxiety ridden.
That segues very well into thesis 4. In contemporary capitalism, the dominant reactive affect is anxiety. Today's public secret is that everyone is anxious. Anxiety has spread from its previously localized locations, such as sexuality, to the whole of the social field. All forms of intensity, self-expression, emotional connection, immediacy, and enjoyment are now laced with anxiety. It has become the linchpin of subordination. So, from the NSA to closed-circuit TV surveillance, performance management reviews, our entire society is geared towards keeping us anxious.
Yeah, like, how often do you hear people talk about having anxiety? Like, it's a thing that happens to them that they have, like, a disorder. Like, I have anxiety, or that these people have anxiety or whatever. But rarely do you hear us talk as a culture about how we have an anxious culture, that we live in an anxiety-inducing era. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a level of conversation that's not the norm anyway.
Right, and we have consciously produced anxiety being imposed upon us by just the ease of disposability in the job market and through surveillance, and employers think of anxiety as a good thing. You know, if you have anxiety about losing your job, you'll do a better job, you'll be more productive. So there's, you know, in a job market like ours, where we've got 100 bachelor's degrees for every spot that doesn't even require a bachelor's degree, you are disposable. You are very easily disposable. And that has created a situation where the people who don't have any sort of certifications or education are even more precarious and have even less recourse when it comes to, you know, speaking out about their job conditions, so that people are able to deal with creeping immiseration, which sort of brings things about full circle. Like, we've eroded the gains of the first two of the first two theses, you know, and are now going into a situation where we're simultaneously anxious, bored, and miserable.
Well, yeah, and we've individualized that anxiety. So now, especially since it's seen
that's
as
conscious
like
too.
Well, yeah. So yeah, we've individualized anxiety by seeing it as this like very specific pathologized problem with like a code, you know, that you need to maybe be medicated for, but also definitely like figure out what's wrong with you, right? So there's this like huge booming self-help industry and like influencers on the gram and YouTube to tell you how you can deal with a world that is like designed to make us Looney Tunes daily. And that blends into our responses to this world, even in leftist circles. So you see these individualized solutions. You know, we have to think like, well, what can we do? What do we have control of? Well, I can go for a jog in the morning and eat better or whatever. And then the same thing happens, you know, when we go to a meeting and it's like, well, you can call your congressperson and you can watch the words that you say and, you know, be really cautious about your language. You can check your privilege. These are the individual things that you can do. And not to say that none of those things have value or have a place, but they've replaced actually thinking about collective solutions to the anxiety that is the natural outcome of this shitstorm of a world and system that we live in.
Does that ever just hit the nail on the head too with a sense of disposability that's infected the way all of us approach even left organizing, where we've taken this culture of disposability created by, you know, atomic age capitalism, superabundance, where consumption is the prime directive of everything. Everything needs to be disposable. Anything has even the slightest wear or tear or problem or anything's wrong with it at all, just throw it away, replace it, get the new thing. And that's like completely encased the way that we think about the world and each other, even to the point that, like, we, you know, when a corporation gets in trouble for something, what, you know, they fire the people who were responsible for the thing that got them in trouble. They make a big show of how they're really sorry about this bad thing. Well, look, and look, we, you know, we paid penance, we threw away the bad actors and we're good now. Or, you know, we dumped the brand, you know, the brand that we had before and created a new shell corporation. And you know, we disposed of the bad actors and we now have this good one. And it's trained us to sort of operate in this like mode of thinking. When there's something wrong, we have to attack, go in and attack until the bad actor has been disposed of. And that puts us all in this position of feeling our own, disposability, you know, like feeling anxious at all times, at all any turn, we could be the next thing that is disposed of, because that the culture of disposability is so infected all of us in every part of the way we think and just interact with the world around us, that we even intuitively understand that to apply to ourselves. And God, is that anxiety inducing. You know, on top of just like consuming culture that plays on our anxieties about our own, encourages your own sort of insecurities and says you're not good enough, you're not enough, you are inadequate. You've just got to buy the, you know, this product or whatever that will bring you satisfaction, will, you know, make your life fulfilled or whatever.
There is one really great, a really important sort of manifestation of that disposability culture and the way we've internalized it, and the way that anxiety is sort of concentrated, that generalized anxiety is really concentrated in human behavior, is the switch from absenteeism to presenteeism that they mention in the essay, that I actually thought was really prescient, or it was really that's probably the best example of the way in which anxiety now dominates where boredom used to, because absenteeism is, you know, what you do when you think your work is meaningless and you can get away with slacking off because nobody cares because nothing's important, and it's as long as things look like they're being done, you can duck out as much as possible. And nowadays, because people are so afraid of being let go at the drop of a hat, because they know nothing about job security, and everything's constantly being downsized and bought and sold and stripped down and merged, whatever. Like, I mean, I work in offices, and people go out of their way to be as present as possible. Sometimes to an incredibly absurd level where you're just like, why are people still here? You know? And I think that stands out as a pretty good sort of, marker for how much anxiety, influences and dominates our mode of work.
Okay, so thesis number 5. Anxiety is a public secret. Excessive anxiety and stress are a public secret. When discussed at all, they are understood as individual psychological problems, often blamed on faulty thought patterns or poor adaptation. Indeed, the dominant public narrative suggests that we need more stress so as to keep us safe. Anxiety is channeled downwards. People's lack of control over their lives leads to an obsessive struggle to reclaim control by micromanaging whatever one can control. Parental management techniques are advertised to reduce parents' anxiety by providing a definite script they can follow. Anxiety is personalized in a number of ways. 100 varieties of management discourse, time management, anger management.
Yeah.
Parental management, self-branding, gamification, offer anxious subjects the illusion of control and return for an ever greater conformity to the capitalist mode of subjectivity. And this goes on to talk about the self-esteem industry, like we were mentioning earlier, how people can achieve success through positive thinking.
Good vibes then, only, man.
Yeah, no bad days. So people have to be socially isolated in order for a public secret to work. Authentic communication is increasingly rare. Communication is more pervasive than ever, but increasingly communication happens only through paths mediated by the system. Hence, in many ways, people are prevented from actually communicating. Even while the system demands that everyone be connected and communicable, people both conform to the demands to communicate rather than expressing themselves and self-censor within mediated spaces. And that's one of the things that Mark Fisher talked about, was that people spend like, you know, an hour typing out a text message just so that they are correctly conveying nonchalance.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah, you got to pick the right emojis or else a conversation could go completely differently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel like that you read so much of that section. I'm like, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was reading to retroactively go back and talk about to cover all the stuff that we just talked about.
Right. By the time you get to anxiety as a public secret, what we're really doing is we're recapitulating and starting to draw conclusions. So like, you know, at the beginning, there's the establishment of like what a public secret is and how the various periods have different, you know, sort of psychological affectations. And I think that anxiety is a public secret is pretty well covered by the conversation up to this point. You know, like when we were saying, everybody talks about having anxiety as like a disorder as an individual's. So we're all pretty well aware of the fact that anxiety is generalized, but we don't talk about it like a social problem. But I mean, we talk about it like a social problem in the way that you might talk about like addiction is a social problem. A whole bunch of individuals have addictions or have anxiety, and mm-hmm. that aggregates to a social problem. But we don't talk about as how anxiety is generalized, because it is a byproduct and feature and even in some cases driving mechanism.
It didn't of used to be like yeah. this. It doesn't have to be like this. Yet it is like this.
I feel like Marxists, good Marxists, do talk about anxiety like that.
I think a lot of people talk about it like in the way that they talk about capitalism causes alienation. So that's why we have to have a revolution. That's why we have to, you know. But I don't know if we have had like a long period of like sophisticated discussion about the social function of these things and the ways in which political practice on our part might enforce yeah. it and even exacerbate it.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
And I think that's the thing about it being a public secret is like it's hyper normalized to the point where it's not even really dealt with, even though it is acknowledged.
Well, and I think that's what Fisher is getting at when he says we have to politicize anxiety. I mean, I can't say we haven't politicized misery and suffering and following that same logic. You know, I think the left is really theoretically malnourished when it comes to talking about the anxiety that capitalism produces. Like, that's a thing that we say, but I don't know that it's actually been thought through or theorized how to combat it, mm-hmm. you know? And especially since it's something that's preventing us from organizing effectively. So this isn't a read, but it is to say, like, how many of us have, you know, been to a meeting in which, you know, we're discussing, well, how do we better include people who suffer from anxiety? And it's like, well, fucking all of us do, which is, again, not to trivialize the degree of anxiety that people experience. I say this as someone who is struggling with anxiety, developing the sentence, right? Yeah, right. Like, you know, like, I think we can be mindful of those things, too. But, you know, so it's like, yes, we should be thinking about how to include people who are anxious about doing X, Y, or Z task, you know. But also, like, we have to politicize that in our spaces and figure out not just how to, like, work around people's anxieties, but work through them. Yeah. And that's a harder thing to do because it requires us all to like very deliberately work through our shit. And I'm sorry, like as someone who, like I said, that struggles with anxiety very regularly, having anxiety about being on the phone, like is not a good enough reason to not participate in that activity. Having anxiety about speaking one-on-one or face-to-face with people is not a good enough reason to not do those things because that's the work we have to fucking do. That doesn't mean we have to do it tomorrow or right now, but it does mean we have to acknowledge how do we get people to a place in which they can do things like speak in front of people? How do we get people to a place in which they can do things like have the confidence to go organize their workplace? Like, this is what we're against. You don't get to say, I can't do this because my anxiety. You can't do it right now. Great. We have to acknowledge that. We have to respect people where they are, but we don't accept that. Right. We're wimps. And it's okay to be a wimp because I am too around a number of things. But you can't lack the self-awareness to know that, like, it's not okay for us to, like, operate and then organize like this, mm-hmm. you know?
Or rather to...
Am I going to get canceled for this rant?
Yes. Yes, you are.
This is part of the criticism of the way in which we have so thoroughly absorbed the dominant affect of the present order, is that we reproduce the alienation of society in our organizations as the left to the point where being involved in a large gathering, a significant gathering of the left, is itself anxiety inducing rather than uplifting. And so we have to treat the gathering in the same way that we might treat being at the mall or being at the loading dock or being at any place that we don't really want to be because it's anxiety-inducing and alienating, because we haven't produced an environment in our own, you know, supposedly our own spaces, which creates an opposite effect. It's not a liberating space to be in, and so we have to adopt all of these rules that we wish the outside world had, because the best we've been able to do is reproduce the outside world internally. That's the spectacle of opposition, is that we're performing opposition, but it feels exactly the same as not being there.
Hello, Chris here, just dropping in to remind everyone that we have a Patreon account. Right now, we've only got one tier, and it is set at $2. So if you are interested in helping out the show, and you would like to get access to our exclusive content, which we've actually been posting lately, just go ahead and sign up on our only tier for $2. You can feel free to donate as much as you want, but as for now, you'll only get rewards for the $2. Eventually, we might add more tiers in and put really cool stuff, but we don't really have the time to do that right now. So, head on over to Patreon and join for $2. Also, don't forget to add us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and to tell your friends about us. Okay, thanks a lot. Back to the show. Thesis number 6. Current tactics and theories aren't working. We need new tactics and theories to combat anxiety. During periods of mobilization and effective social change, people feel a sense of empowerment, the ability to express themselves, a sense of authenticity and de-repression, or disalienation, which can act as an effective treatment for depression and psychological problems, a kind of peak experience. It is what sustains political activity. Such experiences have become rarer in recent years. So, let's pretend like I said that already, and the conversation that we just had was in response to that.
Well, so, somebody asked me the other day what it was like to be a part of the Occupy moment, because they weren't. They said, like, you know, looking back on it from the outside and from the way that people have talked about it, doesn't really necessarily seem like it's a little bit unclear why it seems like such a watershed moment for people. So the question was, like, what did it actually feel like to be a part of it, like to be right in the thick of it when it was happening? And without thinking at all, without having to really dig deep and spend a moment, you know, dwelling on it, my answer was that it felt like freedom, at least at first.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, like, it's really easy to remember. It's really easy to remember the worst elements of the Occupy moment, which we see replicated in all of the worst elements of today's left, with the endless debates about procedure and, you know, the back and forth about whether consensus or simple majority, and the, you know, the clapping versus twinkling and all of that stuff. But what I think really defined it, in at least in its first instance, was this feeling that you were suddenly not alone, and that suddenly people wanted to hear what you had to say, and suddenly you wanted to hear what other people had to say, mm-hmm. and that the crowd itself was an inviting place, it was an attractive entity to be, like, absorbed into rather than to, you know, to be avoided. And so it felt more human than the average day-to-day, you know, interaction you have with a crowd or with the world and with society. So when this thesis says that those moments seem more and more rare, considering the 8 years that have passed since that time, I feel like I have to agree. That part really rings true, that it's been, that those moments are rare, because I can't think of any other ones like that. And I think, you know, to refer back to the previous conversation, that feeling is, like, glaringly absent in most of what we have for, you know, left-wing organization, as that feeling, like, that the crowd is a thing you want to be a part of, that it's an inviting environment, it's a transformative experience. That part is missing. It's the procedural tinkering and giving a platform to narcissism. Those are the things that seem to define the moment more than the really good stuff.
Yeah. It's interesting that you have those memories of Occupy. I guess you got to go to Chicago and see Occupy there, but I just remember Occupy in Denton.
And that was just an actually bad experience.
Yeah, it was just performative camping. You know? but, you know, maybe there was a little bit of the inclusion that people must have felt. This article says so much of what we do to combat capitalism is anxiety inducing, and the responses to activism by the state are even more anxiety inducing than before. And it uses some examples from British politics that I don't think are necessarily applicable to the United States, like kettling, for one. I don't think that that's a tactic that the US police use, but it's definitely one that the UK police use. Yeah, they'll kettle up protesters and just hold them there, like, surrounded by cops, and not let them leave for hours and hours and hours until, like, everyone's totally exhausted and demoralized. Right, just
ready to leave, yeah.
That and the other thing that they talk about is detaining people without charge for, like, several days and stuff like that.
Well, you have to be charged, what is it, like, in 48 hours or something like that? But they definitely will, maybe it's, like, 24 hours in the U.S., but they'll... They'll definitely arrest people preemptively. That has happened in the U.S. where they'll like raid people's homes and arrest people and then release them without charge. You know, after it's too late for them to like be a leading figure in whatever event is going on. You know,
and basically, it's just talking about these are terror tactics to cause anxiety.
This definitely happened in the wake of the Inauguration Day protests and in the Ferguson uprising. Where, you know, there's mass arrests and roundup of people for just kind of being in a place and being held as long as legally possible before letting them go without charging them with anything.
And then also, there's a pretty good case that Ferguson activists are being murdered. But, you know.
Right. And there's also a lot of people being charged with things in addition to those other two, like, phenomena. But I think that overall... We tend to talk about it less because I think that it tends to be that protest is generally a safer thing in the United States because it's intended to be, you know, with the permits and the, you know, the police escort and we go to the officially designated spot to make the statement. And now everybody knows this is how we feel and we've spoken truth to power and then we go home. It's only whenever it breaks outside of those boundaries and it presents, you know, a modicum of a threat, you know, it threatens to inspire people to do threatening things.
Right. Generally, our involvement with protests has always been like, you know, here's the route, here's your police escort, you know, you know, here's the time that it has to start and here's the time that it has to be over by. And the only time I've really seen police violence against a protest is when we tried to occupy a bridge and stop traffic during the anti-war protests in Austin. And they tased a bunch of kids and actually gave one of them brain damage. I don't know if you guys remember that.
I vaguely remember that. I also definitely remember...
That's because we wouldn't get out of the street.
Right, exactly. I definitely remember right after the election, there were protests in Austin, Texas. You know, like, this is in November, where the protest, you know, they weren't permitted marches and they wandered through the streets and downtown and the police kind of tolerated it, but like tried to cordon it and like sort of redirect traffic. And at a certain point, they just kind of got tired of it. And the short version of that story is that this guy got his neck broken by a police officer. I don't know how germane that any of that is to the discussion.
This says the situation feels hopeless and inescapable, but it isn't. It feels this way because of the effects of precarity, constant overstress, the contraction of time into an eternal present, the vulnerability of each separated or systematically mediated individual, the system's dominance of all aspects of social space. Structurally, the system is vulnerable. The reliance on anxiety is a desperate measure, used in the absence of stronger forms of conformity. The system's attempt to keep running by keeping people feeling powerless leaves it open to sudden ruptures, outbreaks of revolt. So how do we get to the point where we stop feeling powerless? And I think this is where we, or I, anyway, I don't want to speak for you guys, think that this article loses relevance. Because thesis number 7 is, a new style of precarity-focused consciousness raising is needed. And it says a couple of things that I think are, you know, pretty decent and make sense and anybody with half a brain would agree with. It's producing new grounded theory relating to experience. Like, we need to reconnect with our experience now rather than the theories from past phases. And I agree. That makes a certain amount of sense.
Sure. Like, I even think it puts a fine point on it when it says that we should endeavor to transform the unnameable emotions into a sense of injustice.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't think it has very much in the way of, like, prescription for how to do that.
Yeah.
But if we present that as a principle, we elevate that and foreground that as this is the desire.
Yeah, that was basically part 2, was recognizing the reality and systemic nature of our experiences.
Right. So when we talk about
transformation, you know, of emotions,
when we talk about being anxious and being depressed and feeling hopeless, you know, to really bring this all full circle to the reason why we ever talk to each other in this format is that what we're talking about is trying to organize pessimism, like all of that negativity that exists in this diffuse and scattered way that we all take on as like individual burdens. Like that the political task of the present moment is to retranslate that into rage and into a sense of injustice. And that these are things that are happening to you. They're being done to you. They don't come from you. That really should be common sense, but it's not. Even when we say like, oh yeah, capitalism does this to us, we still act as though we're doing it to ourselves.
So the next 2 points of this thesis are that people are paralyzed by unnameable emotions and we have to transform those. And then creating or expressing voice, you know, break the culture of silence surrounding the public secret, which is to name the system as an anxiety inducing, name it as the cause of our social anxieties or of all of our anxieties. And then construct a disalienating space, which, I mean, all these are great things, but it doesn't give us any indication as to how we're supposed to go about doing this. And I guess maybe that's asking a little bit too much.
I think to your point, it gives off a feel, maybe this is uncharitable, but it gives off a feeling of sort of trying to engage in an ideological battle of saying like, these are bad ideas, let's have good ideas instead, you know?
Right. And that's essentially why I thought that this last thesis like breaks down a little bit and is not as helpful as the first 6 theses. How do you construct a disalienated space? Okay, so to construct a disalienated space, all we have to do is like just eschew all the alienation that each individual that creates the space is plagued by.
Yeah.
You know? And then we won't bring any of that alienation into the space. I don't know. That seems to be the anarchist solution to everything. Since, you know, the 1990s was to create spaces where capitalism and all of the bad things about capitalism didn't exist.
So that we could feel good about ourselves. They're called affinity groups?
Well, they're even called affinity groups in this essay.
I know.
So basically, it's telling us that we need to create new situations to deal with these problems. Let's use this old tactic that pretty much doesn't do anything except for allow people to feel comfortable when they're hanging out with their friends and allow them to be isolated and alienate themselves from reality outside. We need to do that as a way to combat alienation. I don't know. It didn't make any sense to me. I completely disagree with the idea that it is possible to, first of all, construct a disalienated space. Right. It reminds me of the way that whenever we used to try to organize with the anarchists and they would say things like, I don't want to like have to talk to people that, you know, I don't want to have to go and talk to some assholes that all they care about is like drinking beer and playing sports and stuff. And I'm like, well, I mean, like, if you want to like change society, you're going to have to interact with the normies on some level. It's not everyone is going to be punk. Some people have sleeves and don't put patches on their shorts, and then you're just going to have to deal with that, you know? And it reminded me of this, like, Michael Albert. You remember that anarchist guy that wrote the
Unfortunately,
the
yeah, I remember
yeah,
him.
Yeah, I remember him.
Yeah.
Who rebranded participatory economics as, like, a new idea. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
He gave this lecture one time, and he mentioned, like, if you really want to connect with working people, you're going to, like, need to go to the places where they are, like, you know. And the guy was like, I don't want to talk to any of those people. Those people make me feel like shit. They make me feel uncomfortable. I don't want to talk to any of them. And he said, like, well, hey, if you want to organize the working class and you don't want to talk to people that make you feel uncomfortable, then, you know, you need to just, you know, be happy staying in your like little punk house or whatever, but don't pretend like you care about changing the world.
Sure. So, I mean, whereas I don't think that we necessarily need to like, go out and make it a point to like try to talk to people in the club or the bar or like on Tinder or whatever about like
that's
our
a good word on Tinder like, whenever people are trying to get laid.
Organizing efforts.
That's what that's called.
I do think that like you have to exist in the real world with people. And if you don't think that there are opportunities to engage with people on a real level or consider yourself part of that population of real people, then that's a reflection of like you and your own shortcomings and not like people who are just like living in this world and trying to like watch the Cowboys win every now and then. Shit.
Yeah, God forbid people have
hopefully
some sort of outlet
more often.
Yeah.
I think we talked about anti-intellectualism a bit in the last episode that we did. And one of the things that Jason said is just like, I'm just a worker, you know, I'm a regular person. I just have a familiarity with this because this is what I've like dedicated all of my free time to for like the past 20 years, you know, but we're not like exceptional.
Sure.
For any reason other than that, this is what we have chosen to do, you know.
Right. We don't have any aims apart from those of the class as it's as a whole.
Who was it that said that? It was like fucking Burt Reynolds or something.
Some old white dude.
Oh God. We need to hear less from old white dudes like me.
In voicing my sort of like disagreement and dissatisfaction with the conclusion, like sort of thesis 7, about like constructing deliberate disalienated affinity groups or whatever. I think it's worth saying that like I don't really know what else is the alternative at the present moment either. Like I can't spend, you know, an hour talking about all of the shortcomings of the present left and then saying, oh yeah, the affinity group anarchist model is so stupid and worthless, because what we actually have to do is, you know, this other thing that I also think is yielding very few results. But that's why I'm not really banging my head against the wall at the moment on the organization question. You know, I'm just sort of talking it through. And I think, you know, people maybe can try to embody this ideal of transforming the unnameable emotions into a sense of injustice and a sense of like righteous indignation. You know, when and where that opportunity is present, you know, whether you're involved in this thing or in that thing, like I think foregrounding that as the aspirational new norm is probably as good as we can do right now. And I think it's going to look really vague and sound really vague, because what qualifies as a possibility is pretty vague, and that's why I'm a pessimist.
Yeah.
But hopefully it won't have to be forever. I just am right now.